introduction. Their power, our powerlessness. Our power, their powerlessness. Each calls the other into being. The world is a puzzling place. Like Alice in Wonderland, people rush to go nowhere. Too many things don't make sense, and the threat of losing one's head is ever present. It seems as if humanity has fallen down the rabbit hole and cannot find a way out. Yet, there is hope. If we can understand how we got here and what keeps us here, we can go forward. Society is divided into two groups of people, a few who wield immense power and the rest who feel varying degrees of powerlessness. As a result, conflicts over power dominate life. Between individuals, the struggle for power kills intimacy. On a social level, competition drives down living standards. On a global scale, the battle for dominance threatens human survival. Power over others and lack of power are both corrupting. However, power, the ability to control events, can also liberate. Power is not the problem. The problem is unequal access to power. For more than 100,000 years, our ancestors lived in cooperative, power-sharing societies. This book explains how the rule of reciprocity was overthrown and how it can be reestablished. My experience as a physician compelled me to write this book. As the sister of a disabled child, I thought the doctors had the power to end suffering, and I wanted that power. After I graduated from medical school, I learned how powerless doctors actually are. Most of my patients' problems were rooted in family dynamics, financial difficulties, and conflicts at school and at work. I studied psychotherapy in the hope that combining mind and body skills would be more useful. It was. I could help people move from uncommon misery to common misery. The problems created by alienation, oppression, and exploitation remained beyond my control. After listening to thousands of people's stories, I have concluded that social power is necessary for human health. Most people lack the happy, healthy, fulfilling lives they deserve because they are kept powerless and mistakenly accept this state of affairs as natural or self-inflicted. In fact, most human suffering is preventable. This book reveals what must be done. Part 1 explains that society does not arise from human nature. On the contrary, current social arrangements violate human nature. Part 2 shows how power is divided by class. Part 3 investigates how power and powerlessness are perpetuated. Part 4 reveals how powerlessness can be transformed into power. Knowing that the material in this book would be controversial, unbelievable to some, I carefully referenced every fact, every quote, and every contentious statement. To my dismay, the final draft contained more than 1,400 references spanning 70 pages. To make the book shorter and more affordable, I cut out most of those references. However, I will be happy to provide specific references on request. A just world is possible. Human beings create society, and we can change it. The need for change is urgent. Everywhere there is injustice, anguish, and anger. This book explains how society shapes people, how people shape society, and how powerlessness can be converted into power to transform the world. Part 1 of Power and Powerlessness. Many Americans we know are horrified by the posture of their government, but seem to be helpless. Harold Pinter. The 21st century is young and already drips with blood. Washington has launched wars against Afghanistan and Iraq and backed Israel to destroy Lebanon. When Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, the most powerful government in the world abandoned its poor to die. Ordinary Americans have lost jobs, pensions, and health care, while oil profiteers reap billions in tax cuts. Secret prisons, systematic torture, and domestic spying confirm the corruption at the heart of the system. Why is this happening? The usual explanations blame human nature as if nothing can be done. The inability to change society is an extension of the powerlessness that most people feel every day at the hands of supervisors, bosses and bureaucrats, at home, at school, in the market, on the street, and at work. How can justice be achieved when so many people feel powerless in so many ways? Do we have the world we deserve, or is there another explanation? Part 1 addresses these questions. Chapter 1, Does Anybody Really Care?, provides evidence that people do care about one another. Chapter 2, Compassion Isn't Cost-Effective, shows how capitalism blocks compassion. Chapter 3, Who Needs a Heart When a Heart Can Be Broken?, explains how dissociation helps people endure what they cannot change. Chapter 4, Nature's Youngest Child, reveals how capitalism prevents people from solving social problems. Chapter 1, Does Anybody Really Care? Bill Moyers recalls looking at photos of his grandchildren and thinking, we are stealing their future, betraying their trust, despoiling their world. And I ask myself, why? Is it because we don't care? Because we are greedy? Because we've lost our capacity for outrage, our ability to sustain indignation at injustice? What has happened to our moral imagination? Such questions demand answers. Every day, crowds of people stream past homeless beggars. Few respond to their pleas for help. One cold Christmas morning, I watched two men walk up to a bank machine. A homeless woman lay sleeping in front of it. They stepped over her to withdraw some money, and as they turned to leave, stepped back over her without interrupting their conversation. Events like these reinforce the belief that people are naturally selfish and that social problems result from original sin or human nature. Is this true? Let's examine the evidence. Are people heartless? A poster campaign to raise money for charity shows a half-naked toddler sitting in a pile of garbage with the caption, "How young do they have to be before we give a damn?" The poster implies that people are so indifferent to suffering that they must be shocked or shamed into caring. In fact, people are not indifferent at all. Over 70% of Americans think that the government should ensure that no one goes without food, clothing, or shelter. People also dig into their own pockets to help. The Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies raised over $1 billion in 1 month to aid the victims of the 2004 Asian tsunami. 85% of this money was contributed by the general public. Prisoners donated their wages, and the homeless emptied their pockets. Of the $250 billion donated to American nonprofit organizations in 2004, less than 5% came from corporations, while more than 75% came from individuals. People show their concern for others every day. Most people prefer to go to work sick than stay at home and increase the burden on their coworkers. Employers literally bank on the altruism of employees. Hospitals and schools are underfunded in the knowledge that workers will expend extra energy to fill the gap. Nearly 55% of people working in medicine and education contribute unpaid overtime, and more than half take work home. People commonly put others' needs before their own. A survey of male and female caregivers of women with advanced breast cancer found that 5% had quit their jobs or turned down a job promotion in order to provide care. 69% had missed days at work, reduced their work hours, and used holidays or taken special leave to support their loved ones. Many of these caregivers suffered anxiety and depression. Despite the strain on their jobs, finances, and health, they reported being very satisfied with their choice to put caregiving first. In everyday human interactions, people who are caring and compassionate are highly valued. Are people lazy? Some say that more people don't protest injustice or support social causes because they are lazy. If that were true, there would be no volunteers. Over 80 million Americans donate 20 billion hours of their time every year volunteering in hospitals, hospices, nursing homes, fire departments, rescue squads, shelters, halfway houses, counseling services, and church programs. This does not include the many hours that people spend helping family, friends, and neighbors. If people were lazy, no one would participate in bike-a-thons, walk-a-thons, and other fundraising events for charity. If people were lazy, no one would campaign for civil rights or build a union. If people were lazy, they would do nothing after work instead of playing sports, fixing cars, gardening, dancing, painting, and making things for their children. If people were lazy, then the jobs that demanded the least work would be the most desirable. In reality, having nothing to do makes people feel useless. Human beings have a strong need to contribute, and many seniors seek work after retirement for that reason. Do people have it too good? Some complain that most people are too well off to rock the boat. A few people do benefit from how things are and don't want anything to change. However, most people's living standards are falling. In 2003, the United Nations found that living standards in more than 50 countries had declined over the previous 10 years. The World Health Organization estimates that, quote, more than 2.6 billion people, about 40% of those on the planet, have no access to basic sanitation or adequate toilet facilities. More than a billion people have no access to clean water sources, and an estimated 4,000 children die every day from illness caused by lack of safe water and sanitation. In rich nations, falling living standards can be seen in the increase in part-time and contract jobs, longer working hours, fewer benefits, rising debt, loss of social supports, more stress, and more poverty. In America's Forgotten Majority, Why the White Working Class Still Matters, Roy Teixeira and Joel Rogers found that a 50-year-old white male high school graduate earned between $2,000 and $3,000 a year less in 1996 than he would have earned 10 years earlier. From 1973 to 1998, in an economy that almost doubled in real terms, the wage of the typical worker in production and non-supervisory jobs, 80% of the workforce, actually declined by 6%, from $13.61 to $12.77 an hour. Based on a 40-hour week, this turns out to be a loss of about $1,750 a year for the typical worker. Close quote. In the world's richest nation, more than 11% of households have difficulty putting food on the table. More than 45 million Americans cannot afford medical insurance. 28% of uninsured adults with serious medical problems cannot afford to buy the medicines they need. More than 40% of working Americans have medical debts, and half of all personal bankruptcies are health-related. With living standards declining for so many people, we can't explain low levels of social protest on people having it too good. Are people ignorant? It is commonly thought that if enough people knew what was going on, they would never put up with it. This belief motivates some people to dedicate their lives to revealing the truth. Since the 1970s, Dr. Helen Caldicott has campaigned to educate the public about the dangers of nuclear power. Over the same period, Dr. Samuel Epstein has thoroughly documented how industrial pollution causes cancer. Countless others have exposed how the drive for profit creates needless misery for human beings and destroys the environment. These messages have found an audience. Most Americans think business leaders and politicians are corrupt and self-serving, and 86% want stricter laws and regulations to protect the environment. In 2004, Michael Moore's anti-war movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, broke the record for the largest grossing documentary ever. By mid-2005, the majority of Americans believed that the U.S. had launched its war against Iraq on false pretenses, that the president and his advisors had lied to the country, and that the war was not worth it. Yet the president remained in office, and the war continued. Most people do know what is going on. They may not know all the details, but they know the basics: that the world is run for the rich and powerful at the expense of everyone and everything else. If the truth alone could change the world, it would have changed by now. Later chapters will explain how society is structured to keep most people feeling powerless most of the time, regardless of what they know. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. To care is human. People show kindness and caring every day. We help each other with directions, adopt stray animals, return lost objects, and comfort each other in hard times. Such considerations are ignored by a media machine that provides us with a daily diet of assault, child abuse, murder, war, and other atrocities. Sometimes the generosity of ordinary people does hit the news. On 9/11, firefighters raced into the burning World Trade Center with no thought for their own safety and died when the towers collapsed. The bridges to Manhattan were clogged with people rushing downtown to help. Construction workers left their jobs to search for survivors, and volunteers lined up to give blood. Dr. Robert Jones, director of New York City's Blood Services, described how, quote, within an hour of the attack, donors appeared, lining up around the block, wanting to donate blood. Even when you tried to explain to blood donors that this was not going to be helpful at this time, they still felt compelled by some social value that they were experiencing to donate at that time. They just had to do it, close quote. The amount of donated blood overwhelmed the system. 500,000 units were collected, while fewer than 260 units were used. That same day, 17 Canadian towns and cities took in almost 34,000 stranded airplane passengers from the United States. When 38 jets were diverted to a small town in Newfoundland, local people opened their hearts, their homes, and their wallets. Striking school bus drivers left picket lines to drive plane loads of passengers to community shelters. Doctors and nurses set up clinics where passengers could get their prescriptions filled, and pharmacies filled them for free. Canadian air traffic controllers cooked massive quantities of chili, bacon, and eggs for the visitors. Northwest Airlines Captain Dan Runick told reporters, I had prepared my passengers to ration their food and their water. For the people of that locale to empty their pantries and open their homes just took everyone by surprise. Why were they surprised? Because, as the next chapter explains, capitalism cultivates callousness and rewards greed. Summary. Social problems cannot be blamed on human nature because people can be caring or cruel in different situations. Nevertheless, pessimistic beliefs about human nature persist because the powers that be promote this view, and people go along because they need some way to explain what is wrong in the world. And I'm reading from Susan Rosenthal's Power and Powerlessness. Chapter 2. Compassion isn't cost-effective. It's time to see the world as it really is, Captain James T. Kirk. During my hospital training, I participated in daily rounds where medical staff moved from room to room assessing the patients. One morning, we examined a 35-year-old woman who was suffering from an advanced liver disease. As the convoy of doctors and nurses turned to leave, the patient cried out, "I'm dying! I'm dying! I'm scared!" A nurse responded, "You're not dying, you're going to be fine," and the group moved to the next room. An hour later, I entered the morgue to find this same patient lying on the autopsy table. I was horrified. When I told his senior doctor what happened, he responded, "You'd better get used to it." I got the message, feelings don't matter here. The patient's fears were disregarded, and she was abandoned to die alone. My shock at what happened to her was considered unworthy of discussion. Medical schools teach students that patients' feelings are important. However, in the real world of the busy hospital, feelings are not cost-effective. When we listen to people and care about how they feel, then we want to provide them with what they need. Someone to sit and listen, more detailed explanations, or help with work and family matters. However, there is no profit to be made from providing these services. To maximize productivity, cash-squeezed public hospitals and profit-driven private hospitals treat patients like widgets on an assembly line. Instead of discussing patients by name, medical staff refer to them by diagnosis. The fibroids in room 12 and the pancreatic cancer in room 5, like mechanics working on parts, not people. One psychiatrist describes how compassion is discouraged in his workplace. Quote, every few months, all staff psychiatrists receive a compilation of length of stay statistics, savable days, and other related data listed by individual staff member. Through this process, staff are openly ranked according to the speed with which they discharge their patients. The worst offenders, those who keep their patients in hospital the longest, appearing at the top of the list. These reports, masquerading as information, represent an example of public shaming. I wait in vain for rankings of humanistic parameters such as compassion, empathy, and supportiveness toward patients, or even simpler measures such as providing good treatment or treating other staff well. Close quote. The needs of medical staff are no more important than the needs of patients. Hospitals foster a competitive, suck-it-up mentality to squeeze the most work from the fewest people. As a medical intern, I worked between 80 and 120 hours a week. When your own needs are denied, it becomes easier to deny the needs of others. One night, a patient suffered a heart attack. As the team struggled to resuscitate him, I was appalled to find myself hoping that he would die so I could go to bed. I had been on my feet for 30 hours without a break. The typical underfunded hospital demands that medical trainees take on overwhelming workloads, suffer persistent sleep deprivation, and abandon any personal life. Under such conditions, it is not surprising that student doctors finish their training significantly more depressed, more hostile, and less empathetic than when they began. To raise productivity, capitalism glorifies the efficient professional who has no time for feelings. Popular characters like Spock on Star Trek reject emotions as an obstacle to good decision-making. However, morality, ethics, and values are rooted in emotions or gut feelings that move people towards what they believe is right and away from what they believe is wrong. Without emotions, there would be no anger in response to injustice and no shame in behaving badly. Cultivation of the psychopath. If one were to design a human being that was perfectly suited to the capitalist system, that person would be a psychopath. Someone who is disconnected from emotions, having no empathy and no compassion. The American Psychiatric Association defines a psychopath as someone who exhibits, quote, a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others, as indicated by three or more of the following. Failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behaviors, as indicated by repeatedly performing acts that are grounds for arrest. Deceitfulness, as indicated by repeated lying, use of aliases, conning others for personal profit or pleasure. Impulsivity, or failure to plan ahead. Irritability and aggressiveness as indicated by repeated physical fights or assaults. Reckless disregard for safety of self or others. Consistent irresponsibility as indicated by repeated failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor financial obligations. Lack of remorse as indicated by being indifferent to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another. The documentary film, The Corporation, explains how this definition applies to corporations. Lying, cheating, stealing, hurting people, having a short-term outlook, aggressive behavior, and lack of remorse are standard business practices, making the psychopath the ideal corporate executive. Albert Dunlap, who was described by his biographer as a vicious psychopath, became the darling of the business world during the downsizing frenzy of the 1990s. Dunlap was called Chainsaw Al because he chopped hundreds of thousands of jobs. The more people he laid off, the higher the stock prices climbed. Popular culture presents the psychopath as the villain we love to hate. In the movie Spider-Man, Norman Osborn is a corporate executive whose greed and ambition cause him to develop an evil persona, the Green Goblin. The Goblin is a psychopath who tells Spider-Man, quote, "There are 8 million people in this city, and those teeming masses exist for the sole purpose of lifting exceptional people like us on their shoulders," close quote. Hollywood portrays characters like Norman Osborn as freakish exceptions. In reality, the capitalist can maximize profit only by putting business interests ahead of human needs. To make it in business, all capitalists must behave as if they are psychopaths, whether they are or not. Consider the following example of how one executive was handsomely rewarded for sacrificing children to meet the needs of his corporation. In 2002, Cardinal Bernard F. Law, head of the Archdiocese of Boston, was forced to resign for protecting priests who were sexually molesting children. Law had knowingly moved pedophile priests from parish to parish, where they molested even more children. After Law was disgraced for his role in the child abuse scandal, Pope John Paul II appointed him Archpriest of a Basilica in Rome, a highly influential position. Whether or not he was a psychopath, Law advanced his career by behaving like one. Henry Ford, founder of the Ford Corporation, built an automotive empire by sacrificing human lives. He once stated, "I am not in the business of making cars. I am in the business of making profit." This stance required Ford executives to function like psychopaths. Let's say you had a choice between manufacturing a dangerous vehicle or a safe one. What if the dangerous vehicle was more profitable, even after you included the cost of killing and injuring a certain number of people and generating a predictable number of lawsuits? In the late 1960s, the Ford Motor Company launched the Pinto, knowing that a rear-end collision of more than 30 miles an hour would jam its doors and cause a fuel tank explosion that would incinerate the occupants trapped inside. When asked about the Pinto's exploding gas tank, a Ford engineer admitted, quote, "That's all true, that the car tends to explode in minor accidents. But you miss the point entirely. You see, safety isn't the issue, trunk space is. You have no idea how stiff the competition is over trunk space. Do you realize that if we put a Capri-type tank in the Pinto, you could only get one set of golf clubs in the trunk?" Close quote. Ford developed a $6 modification to the Pinto that would prevent the gas tank from exploding. The company then did a cost-benefit analysis based on how many people might die from exploding gas tanks and how much money Ford would have to pay for each death, about $200,000 per person. This sum turned out to be less than the cost of modifying the fuel tanks of all Pintos, so Ford chose not to apply the modification. How many people died as a result? The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration began investigating automobile fires shortly after the Pinto began rolling off the assembly line. Every year, 400,000 cars were catching fire and burning more than 3,000 people to death. Even though Ford made only 24% of the vehicles on American roads, its cars accounted for 42% of collision-ruptured fuel tanks. It took 10 years for the Department of Transportation to declare that the Pinto had a, quote, safety-related defect. 1.5 million vehicles were recalled, and the Ford Motor Company was charged with reckless homicide. However, the judge acquitted Ford on the basis that it could not be convicted for doing what it was designed to do, make a profit. A society that values profit over people needs policymakers who act like psychopaths. Of course, most executives have social values. However, the greatest rewards are reserved for those who are willing to do whatever it takes to get ahead. In a society that rewards greed, good guys finish last. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. They don't care about us. We have no obligation to make history, We have no obligation to make art. We have no obligation to make a statement. To make money is our only objective. Michael Eisner, CEO of Disney. Governments claim to represent all the people. In practice, they serve business first and foremost. That is why the minimum wage is kept at $5.25 an hour, and why the rich are showered with billions of dollars in tax cuts. Automotive manufacturers continue to deny safety problems, and the state continues to shield them. In 2003, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration decided to, quote, forbid the public release of some data relating to unsafe motor vehicles, unquote, on the basis that publicizing the information would cause substantial competitive harm to manufacturers, close quote. Government loyalty to business is clearest in times of crisis. After the bombing of the World Trade Center, Congress authorized $15 billion in emergency aid to the nation's airlines. Thousands of laid-off airline workers got nothing. Even worse, the government's aid package required airlines to cut the wages and benefits of workers who remained on the job. While Congress took 17 days to rush relief to the airlines, it took 11 months to assemble the first compensation packages for victims' relatives. 25 families were offered a total of $34 million, or less than 0.25% of what the airlines got. More than a year after the tragedy, tens of thousands of people who had applied for emergency assistance were still waiting for their forms to be processed. If 9/11 left any doubts about government priorities, Hurricane Katrina blew them away 4 years later. Public officials knew 3 days in advance that Katrina was going to hit the Gulf Coast. They did nothing. No effort was made to evacuate hundreds of thousands of predominantly poor black people with no way to leave on their own. Sick and disabled people, old people, patients in hospitals and nursing homes, prisoners in locked cells, all were abandoned to the flood. People desperately searching for supplies to survive were branded as looters, and President Bush gave orders to shoot them on sight. After Hurricane Katrina, Congress voted $62 billion to kickstart, quote, one of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen, close quote. While well-connected companies lined up for the loot, the poor got a kick in the pants. The Davis-Bacon Act, that prohibits employers from paying substandard wages on federally financed projects, was suspended for contractors working in the Gulf Coast. New federal contractors were also relieved of any obligation to hire minorities, women, Vietnam veterans, and disabled people on Katrina-related projects. These measures were a boon to business, while forcing those who'd lost everything to work for next to nothing if they could find any work at all. Blaming human nature. Capitalism subordinates compassion, contributing, and cooperation to the pursuit of profit and blames the resulting social problems on human nature. Politicians know that corporate donations butter their bread and return the favor by opening the public purse for whatever business needs, subsidies, tax cuts, war, etc. Meanwhile, there is no, quote, political will to solve social problems like poverty and unemployment. On the contrary, public officials moan about the deficit and cut funds for education, housing, pensions, social assistance, and Medicare. The people at the top of society set the example for everyone else. When authorities display consistent disregard for human needs, it sends the message that humanity as a whole has no compassion. To support the view that human nature is basically selfish, many so-called experts insist that altruism or unselfish concern for others doesn't really exist. Cynics argue that people help others only when it benefits them to do so. Skeptics claim that people offer assistance only to reduce their own distress at witnessing suffering in others. Pessimists insist that people do the right thing only to avoid punishment. Of course, it feels good to help, and assisting others does reduce one's own distress. The question is whether the decision to help is always based on a cost-benefit analysis. Those who believe this refer to the brutal murder of Kitty Genovese in New York City in 1964. 38 people heard her screaming, and no one came to her aid or called the police. Does such behavior prove that people care only for themselves? Researchers set out to answer this question. To test the theory that people aid others only to reduce their own distress, subjects were given the opportunity of reducing their discomfort by escaping from the situation instead of helping. Most people chose to help, even when escape was easier. To investigate the possibility that people help in order to avoid guilt, shame, or punishment, subjects were provided with various excuses they could use to avoid helping, like being told that others had promised to provide aid. Once again, most people preferred to help, even when they had the option of feeling good about not helping. Finally, to discover if people help others only to feel good about themselves, researchers compared subjects who helped a victim with subjects who were informed that someone else had helped the victim. Most people felt just as good when they discovered that the victim had been helped as they felt when they were the ones who did the helping. Other studies show that toddlers as young as 18 months of age are eager to help, even when they are not rewarded for doing so. Add the countless examples of people moving to aid others with no thought to themselves, and we must conclude that human beings have a built-in desire to help that cannot be reduced to personal gain. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Compassion derailed. Although caring and cooperation are instinctive in human beings, we are not slaves to our biology. Social influences play an important role in shaping behavior. The need to urinate is biological. However, where we urinate is socially conditioned. When hunger strikes, we seldom grab the nearest piece of food. An amorous couple will stop their activities when interrupted by the doorbell. Compassion and cooperation are no different. They can be derailed by social conditions. Researchers into the Genovese murder found that compassion can be negated when people think that no real need exists, that they lack the ability to help, or that someone else will solve the problem. No real need exists. When is a scream a cry for help, and when is it a part of a heated argument? When people are uncertain, they may not react. People are more likely to respond to an obvious emergency, especially when others show concern. You cannot help. If people think they lack the skill, strength, or courage to help, they may hold back. Those who feel less confident are less likely to help, while those who feel good about themselves are more likely to help. Someone else will solve the problem. If people think that someone has already called for help, they are less likely to call themselves. If they know that others are unable to help, then they are more likely to act. These three messages, no real need exists, you cannot help, someone else will solve the problem, promote passivity. When President Ronald Reagan condemned welfare queens living high off the hog on social assistance, he was saying that no real need exists because these people are better off than you are. Similarly, the belief that, quote, the poor will always be with us assumes that nothing can be done to eliminate poverty. And when power is concentrated at the top of society, the message is that someone else will solve the problem. The few who rule the many must promote such leave-it-to-us passivity if they want to maintain their rule. Given the extent to which selfishness is modeled at the top of society and passivity promoted in the face of social problems, it is amazing that people care as much as they do. When governments refuse to assist the needy, ordinary people organize fundraising events and volunteer at distress centers, shelters, and soup kitchens. People spend countless unpaid hours raising children, caring for the sick and elderly, and generally supporting one another. Caring about others is so basic to human nature that most people can't understand how it could be displaced by self-interest. Take the example of Carolyn Kelly, age 81, who dove into deep water to save a fellow nursing home resident from drowning. Kelly swam out to the victim and held her head above water until paramedics arrived. When questioned by reporters, Kelly explained that she was a good swimmer and felt she had to help. Everyday heroes typically insist that anyone else would do the same in their place. The next chapter explains how too much pain can cause people to close their hearts in self-protection. Summary: when greed is profitable, compassion is not cost-effective. To justify heartless social priorities, quote, experts insist that selfishness is basic to human nature. Nevertheless, ordinary people value compassion and generosity because their everyday lives depend upon it. I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Chapter 3. Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? Emotional pain can be so unbearable that feeling nothing at all can seem preferable. In a world of pain, nature provides a defense against suffering. Dissociation. Dissociation is a double-edged sword. It helps people tolerate what they cannot change. It also blocks awareness of the need for change. Dissociation was first identified in the late 19th century by Jean-Martin Charcot, a physician working at an asylum for the sick and destitute in France. Instead of dismissing his patients as raving lunatics, Charcot listened to them and concluded that they had been traumatized. Charcot's student Pierre Janet proposed that some experiences are so traumatic that they cannot be integrated into a person's understanding of the world, so they are split off from conscious awareness. In short, dissociation provides an escape when there is no escape. On hearing that her son had been killed, a mother reported feeling numb and unable to move, as if she were suspended in space. Unfortunately, dissociation has a price. Janet explained that dissociated fragments of experience can intrude into a person's consciousness as frightening thoughts, feelings, and images, compulsive behaviors, and physical symptoms. Feeling disconnected can also cause depression, anxiety, and low self-esteem. Efforts to counter the distress of dissociation can create more problems, including addictions, self-destructive behaviors, and violence towards others. For example, emotional numbness can be so disturbing that a person may engage in risky activities in order to feel something. Someone else may combat frightening mental images with obsessive thoughts and compulsive rituals. Another person may blame her sense of disconnection on someone else, become angry or violent toward that person, then feel ashamed and get drunk for relief. Despite the many problems it creates, Janet believed that dissociation helped people to cope with trauma by separating contradictory experiences to avoid inner conflict, triggering automatic self-preserving behaviors, disconnecting the sense of self from the intolerable experience. This new trauma-based approach to illness caused tremendous excitement in the medical world. In 1890 alone, 5 conferences on dissociation were held in Europe and the United States. In 1906, Janet was invited to give an inaugural series of lectures at Harvard Medical School. Distinguished scientists flocked to study under Charcot, including the 29-year-old Sigmund Freud, who traveled to Paris in 1885. While Charcot believed that any kind of trauma could make people sick, Freud insisted that childhood sexual abuse was the primary cause of nervous disorders. Back in Vienna, this theory proved very unpopular. In response, Freud did an about-turn and proclaimed that patients' stories of childhood sexual trauma were simply fantasies that should not be believed. Freud developed psychoanalysis on the basis that inner conflict, not external experience, was the cause of illness. In We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World's Getting Worse, James Hillman and Michael Ventura point out that social problems cannot be solved by emphasizing what happens inside people's heads instead of in their lives. Janet's theory of traumatic dissociation became popular during a time of social rebellion. The following period was more conservative and favored Freud's theory. World War I revived the interest in the link between trauma and illness. Today, dissociation remains politically controversial because it places human suffering in a social context. Everyday dissociation. In The Stranger in the Mirror, Marlene Steinberg explains that dissociation is far more common than people think. While severe forms of dissociation occur in response to traumatic events, mild or moderate experiences of dissociation are as common in otherwise normal people as anxiety and depression, close quote. Such experiences include not recognizing yourself in the mirror, staring into space and losing track of time, being uncertain whether a memory was from a dream or reality, feeling outside of oneself, both as an observer and a participant, feeling that one was watching a movie of one's progression through life, experiencing a numbing of emotions, missing parts of conversations, and being unable to remember something one has just done. Dissociation is common because the world is full of contradictory, distressing experiences. Every day, most people go to jobs where they have no control over what they do. Everywhere, the few dominate the many, and immense wealth exists alongside enormous deprivation. Unfairness normally generates anger that pushes us to set things right. Feeling powerless to correct what is wrong is frightening, so people don't think about it. They dissociate. The media promotes such dissociation. A newspaper report on famine is placed next to an advertisement for expensive jewelry. The reader looks at the report and feels bad about people starving, then sees the advertisement and admires the jewelry, or vice versa. The physical separation between the two items encourages this switch in feelings. The question of why some people can't afford food while others can afford diamonds is also avoided. Dissociation allows people to respond to conflicting aspects of life as if they were not related. Through the mechanism of dissociation, divisions within society are reproduced within the human mind. Lack of control over work, called alienation, results in psychological dissociation from the work process. People feel disconnected from their labor, from themselves, from each other, and from the world. While dissociation provides temporary comfort, it allows oppression, exploitation, and inequality to continue. Dissociation in the face of injustice is mistakenly perceived as a lack of caring instead of what it really is, a psychological defense against the inability to turn caring into action. Doublespeak. In the futuristic novel 1984, the main character works at the Ministry of Truth, where his job is deleting facts from the public records. To eliminate internal conflict over what he does, he convinces himself that the version of history he creates every day is real. The author uses the term doublethink to describe how someone can believe two contradictory things at the same time. Double speak is a similar form of dissociation that is used to make the unacceptable acceptable, like calling welfare cuts back to work measures. Double speak is used regularly by governments, corporations, media, advertisers, and the military. The more reprehensible the action, the more lies are needed to make it palatable. Not surprisingly, the military takes a prize for double speak. War is defense. Death is collateral damage. A freedom fighter is a terrorist working for us, and a terrorist is a freedom fighter working for them. Politicians are especially skilled at doublespeak. While the U.S. was bombing Afghanistan and killing innocent people, President George W. Bush appealed to Americans to send money to the White House to help Afghan children. School students prepared care packages for Afghan refugees, and the United Nations pledged that year's Halloween UNICEF collection to Afghan children. What's wrong with this picture? Knowing that most people are repulsed by mass murder, warmongers make humanitarian gestures to present themselves as compassionate people with good intentions. Expressing concern for those you attack and urging people to rally around your concern channels distress about war into activities that support war and those who wage it. When anti-war activists pointed out the contradiction of sending aid to Afghanistan and bombing the country at the same time, many people reacted with hostility. It is impossible to reconcile the image of America as a savior of the oppressed with the image of America as a terrorist state. official doublespeak made it easier for people to dissociate from the fact that their government was conducting mass murder in their name. Doublespeak invites people to dissociate, and dissociation helps people to accept contradictions, to love their own children and support wars that kill other people's children, to want help when they run into trouble and condemn others needing social assistance, to feel anger at being hurt and defend those who hurt them. When thinking brings pain, dissociation helps people move through life without thinking. Doublespeak also helps wrongdoers dissociate. When people in power who are not psychopaths are compelled to act like psychopaths, when they can reach their goals only by harming others, they must dissociate. They cannot allow themselves to feel compassion for their victims, or they would be unable to do their jobs. They must convince themselves that they are doing the right thing. They must believe their own lies. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Under severe stress, the body produces pain-killing chemicals called internal opiates that are identical to external opiates like morphine and heroin. These chemicals block fear and pain so the wounded can escape to safety. Injured soldiers and accident victims often report feeling no pain for some time. When there is no escape, these same opiates make death easier. Internal opiates contribute to the dissociated or altered states of consciousness that occur during severe stress. There may be some sense of detachment. I floated out of my body. Feelings of unreality. It was like watching a movie. An altered sense of time. Time stood still. Automatic movements. It was like a higher power took over, and feeling numb. This state of mind is featured in the movie Fearless. The main character is a passenger on an airplane that is about to crash. At first, he is terrified. When he realizes he cannot escape death, he becomes calm, even blissful, despite the chaos around him. In a world of uncertainty, danger, and pain, dissociation functions like a welcome drug. The unbearable can be tolerated when emotions are numbed. However, there is a cost. Dissociation numbs all emotions, including the positive ones, making life seem flat and empty. Severe dissociation numbs feelings of compassion and empathy, making it possible for people to do cruel and monstrous things that they would never do in a non-dissociated state. Milder forms of dissociation make it easier to live as if the world were more safe and more fair than it really is. Being comfortably numb also has a price. Recall the cartoon ostrich that buries its head in the sand, only to be kicked in the butt. By numbing fear, anger, and pain, dissociation reduces motivation to solve problems that should be solved. It used to puzzle me that people would change the subject when I talked about social problems. At first, I assumed they didn't care. It took some time before I realized that discussing problems can make people feel powerless and frustrated when they think there is no solution. People have a limited tolerance for pain, and it makes sense to avoid what you think you cannot change. One man confessed that he dodges beggars on the street because he feels so bad that he can't help. A woman admitted outright, "If I don't care, then it won't hurt so much." People don't need to care more. They need more solutions. Believing that a problem can be solved makes it possible to bear the pain of that problem. The next chapter explains how people's natural problem-solving abilities are discouraged by society. Summary: people dissociate in response to painful contradictions and seemingly unsolvable problems. Dissociation makes feeling powerless more tolerable, while allowing intolerable situations to continue.